The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Today, we'll be talking about heart disease prevention and heart disease in women. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Gina Lundberg. Dr. Lundberg is an associate professor of medicine at Emory University and clinical director of the Emory Women's Heart Center. She's a preventive cardiologist and has practiced at Emory St. Joseph's Hospital of Atlanta since 1998. She was invited to join the Emory University faculty in 2012 and led the development of the Emory Women's Heart Program with 6 locations across the metro Atlanta area. She is a National American Heart Association spokesperson. Governor Sonny Perdue appointed Dr. Lundberg to the advisory board for the Department of Women's Health for the state of Georgia in 2007 till 2011. Dr. Lundberg has been a board member of the American Heart Association for Atlanta, and she's been involved in the Go Red for Women initiative for the metro Atlanta area since its development in 2003. She served on the American College of Cardiology Foundation Prevention of Cardiovascular Disease Committee and is the recipient of numerous accolades and awards, and I could go on and on describing all of them. But Dr. Lundberg, I'm so glad to have you on the podcast this morning.
Thank you, Dr. Berquist, and I'm so honored to be here with you.
Yes.
You're such a leader in health.
Well, thank you, and I'm so excited to be talking about heart disease because it is the number one killer in this country, and I know many of our listeners are going to be able to relate to this topic. And of course, the timing couldn't be better since we recently had some new cholesterol guidelines come through. So let's start about talking about heart disease and its prevention in general. What are some kind of common themes or areas or things that you think maybe don't get communicated enough about our understanding of heart disease?
Well, I think you already touched on the very most important thing, that heart disease is the number one killer of men and women in the United States, and it far exceeds all forms of cancers combined. So while women tend to be very focused on their gynecologic health and get pap smears and mammograms, they frequently aren't aware that that is far likely a less cause of death, in that cardiovascular disease is the number one cause, and it's even the number one cause in women who've survived breast cancer. So we all need to be aware of the risk reduction, the things we can do to prevent it, and our family histories of heart disease.
Yeah, and this component of prevention, how effective would you say the preventive lifestyle is in managing heart disease?
Well, we believe that 80% of cardiovascular disease could be prevented with healthy lifestyle and risk reduction management. So that's a huge opportunity for reducing these events. In the news, they've been talking more about how eventually cancer deaths will exceed cardiovascular deaths, and that's because our preventive mechanisms are so helpful. Healthy lifestyle, particularly exercise and good diet, are so foundational to long-term health.
And to break down each component, so for the exercise piece, how often should people be exercising? What type of exercise? And how would you say exercise compares to maybe more traditional ways that prevention gets managed, such as with medication?
Well, I think one of the keys to exercise is it needs to be routine. And it's not just activities of daily living. So often my patients will say, well, I'm very active. I don't go to the gym and exercise. I don't have a walking routine, but I'm very, very active. And they think that means it's enough. But we've learned, particularly from people wearing these Fitbit monitors and pedometers, that an active lifestyle may only get you 5,000 steps a day. It's not, we feel busy and exhausted all day, but we don't really get exercise. Exercise is continuous cardio, such as walking, biking, but it can also be a rowing machine, an elliptical. It can be indoors or outdoors. But it needs to be at least 30 minutes of sustained cardio activity 5 days a week, and that's meant to give you a total of 150 minutes a week. We also think exercise of a more vigorous intensity, 75 minutes a week, is excellent. And it needs to be consistent. You can't go be the weekend warrior who tries to get it all in on Saturday and then does nothing the rest of the week. That's actually quite dangerous. So it needs to be consistent. You need to have a warm-up, a cool-down. It needs to be a reasonable routine. I see too many older people try to go to these intense gyms such as CrossFit, and then they get injured and they're not slowly building up to that level of activity. But routine, consistent activity. And I also tell people, pick something you like. I've got a lot of patients who join Zumba or line dancing or tango or ballroom dancing because they enjoy it more and then they stick with it. I've got a lot of older patients doing pickleball and group activities, which interestingly, a study just came out that says if you do group activities that use hand and arm activities, such as tennis, you get more not only physical fitness, but you get more cognitive fitness, and there's less dementia in these groups. So it's a total body win to go exercise.
And how about, you know, the guidelines from the CDC also mention you can do maybe 3 10-minute increments as opposed to 1 30-minute. With regards to cardiovascular disease prevention, do you think it needs to be a continuous 30 minutes?
Well, the new guidelines are using the mantra, some is best, more is better. So if you're not doing any, let's say you have a rheumatologic disorder or you're just very limited on time, 10 minutes three times a day is definitely better than nothing. But if you can do the continuous 30 minutes, 45 minutes, that's even better. So we want people who are doing none to start doing some, and people who are doing some to consider doing more. And that way they get the maximum benefit.
And with regards to maybe making it apples and apples and putting it in the perspective of how effective it is compared to taking a baby aspirin or a statin cholesterol medication, how would you compare exercise?
Well, I think all preventive cardiologists agree that exercise is our best prescription. It's more effective than anything we do medication-wise. But it's important that it starts early. So interestingly, a lot of patients will come in their 60s and say, I want to start a prevention program. And unfortunately, I have to kind of chuckle because prevention should be started by 40. It's really what we need to be doing in our 30s and 40s and continue through our 60s so that we get the benefit in our 60s, 70s, and 80s. You can't really wait till you're your 70s or 80s to start a prevention program. By then, it's more of a maintenance program. It's still important. I want my older patients to do it as well. But the best thing is for women in their 20s and 30s, after they're done with childbearing, start an exercise routine, get the baby weight off, and stay active your whole life.
Yeah, and even kids, because, of course, we're seeing early signs of heart disease with cholesterol. You know, I've seen studies as early as 7 years old. So encouraging it even younger, I guess your point is well made. We see the manifestations late in life, but the disease starts to brew across really our entire life.
Yeah, the increasing obesity among children is just completely worrisome. We're seeing the adult onset type diabetes in these young people. We're seeing acute kidney failure after chronic kidney disease. We're seeing high blood pressure. We're seeing a lot of these atherosclerotic and cardiovascular diseases in young people, people that shouldn't be having this. And so we really do have to limit screen time, get kids engaged. I say the best way to get your kids to have a healthy lifestyle is for them to see you do it. You can't just say, go outside and play. They need to see you outside doing activities, doing yard work, doing exercise. Just go for a walk together, spend more time with your kids doing healthy routine exercise. And that'll make a huge difference in their lifetime long term.
Yeah, and it's really fun as a family to get out there and do things together. So I think that does give kids a wonderful foundation. And with regards to the dietary component, so, you know, dietary information can be obviously confusing because there's so many diets and maybe certain things are referred to as healthy but may not necessarily be healthy from the standpoint of cardiovascular disease. What type of diet do you recommend for your patients for heart disease prevention?
Well, in cardiology, there's really two diets that we recommend, and they're extremely similar. We use the DASH, dietary approaches to stop hypertension, for our high blood pressure patients, and then we recommend the Mediterranean diet for cardiovascular disease and high cholesterol. They're both plant-based. They recommend that patients mostly have fruits and vegetables with whole grains, brown rice, quinoa, those types of whole grains, as opposed to white rice, white pasta. More heavy in seafood, fish, a little chicken, and very rarely having beef. Watching the fats, using olive oil, canola oil. Those are both important in both diets. I've learned over the years that when I tell patients they need to lose weight, they get focused on the scales and what the number shows. And then I've seen them do some diets that while you get weight loss, you're not using good nutrition, so you're not healthy when you get the result. For instance, I've had patients who've lost 25, 30 pounds on the keto diet or the paleo diet, but then they come back and their triglycerides are very high, their blood sugar may be high, they may be having elevated uric acid, the kidney function has been affected negatively, a lot of bad things happening. So I've learned to focus on, I want you to have good nutrition, good plant-based nutrition, and then the weight loss will follow. Because too often we've made weight loss the goal, but we've used some very unhealthy ways to get there. So I think the Mediterranean diet, the DASH diet, are the ways that most preventive cardiologists are telling patients to eat. And that's also reinforced by the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiologists.
Yeah, and I'm so glad to hear you say that. I see the same of the focus being weight loss, and in terms of health promotion while losing weight, I think sometimes that gets lost in really the more sustainable diets that people can follow are, you know, exactly the ones that you mentioned. So I'm very glad to hear you say that. And that brings us to the whole cholesterol diet component of all this, because I think a lot of my patients certainly want to manage their cholesterol naturally, you know, through lifestyle, through diet. And what are specific, I guess, things to think about for the good cholesterol, the bad cholesterol? Like if people want to raise the good, lower the bad. I know the diets that you just mentioned would do that. Are there specific foods within those diets that they should avoid or ones that they should emphasize?
Well, that's a complicated question, but I'm going to try to give you a brief answer. So a lot of the patients I'm seeing have are already going toward metabolic syndrome. They're gaining weight around the abdomen. Their blood sugars are creeping up. Their blood pressure is at the upper limits of normal, mildly elevated zone. And the HDL is dropping and the triglycerides are rising. And I think those patients really need to be concerned about their glycemic index in their foods, the amount of unhealthy carbs they're eating. So when patients say I'm, you know, following low carb, they generally mean I'm avoiding bread, pasta, rice. But of course, the fruits and vegetables are carb too. So I reinforce that on the fruits, I tell them they need farm fruits. That's fruits that grow on a farm, like berries and melons, and that they want to avoid tropical fruits such as bananas, pineapples, papaya, mango, because they're high in sugar. I also tell them on the vegetables, they want to have things that you would put in a stir fry. So that would be broccoli, cauliflower, zucchini, squash, peppers, onions, mushrooms. But they want to avoid more of the carby beans, the starchy beans, the potato. When you have potato, you need a small amount, and usually sweet potato is preferred. But they also have to cut out the sugar, the unprocessed sugar, the sweets, the pastries, the cookies, the pies. Those really have to go. And so I think in general, that type of diet helps people get their triglycerides down and watches them as far as developing diabetes. Exercise is the main way to get your HDL up. And if you can get younger, that helps too. And then in women, as they get closer to menopause, their HDL drops. So I tell most people, while you can't get younger or make your ovaries work again, you can control the amount of exercise and you can limit the sweets, which will increase the triglycerides. And when the triglycerides are up, the HDL is down. So that's trying to be it in a nutshell, but it's very complicated.
Right, but those are really great pointers. And with the new cholesterol guidelines, which of course is very timely that we have a chance to talk, can you, I know this is such a broad question, but maybe point out some really unique or new differences between the current cholesterol guidelines. I know it's been an evolution really in recent years of first targeting a number, then targeting people who are high risk in general without focusing on number, and now really combining both elements of figuring out who's high risk and who needs to be treated and having a certain cholesterol number target. Can you maybe point out some of the factors that you think are the most salient about these new guidelines?
Well, I think the first important thing is how inclusive it is. It really looks at all the cardiovascular risk factors that are out there, some that your audience probably isn't aware of, and included them in considering when to use a statin and when not to. So while we know things like you've already had a heart attack, you've had bypass surgery, you've had a stent, you've had a stroke, those are all very high risk. Those patients should absolutely be on a statin or reducing their cholesterol with non-statins. The guidelines now include things to add to the statin or alternatives to the statin, such as Zetia, and then the new injections. Amgen has Repatha, and there's Praluent. So it finally includes some of these alternatives, but it also lists groups that are very high risk, such as patients who have familial hypercholesterolemia, that's premature heart disease and very, very high cholesterol that runs in families. It's autosomal dominant. So if you have that gene, you're going to have that really high cholesterol and that really high risk for cardiovascular events. Once again, it included chronic kidney disease, which is important, and smokers. But it added groups that we've known were high risk but weren't in the guidelines. So they've added groups that have high inflammation, such as patients with psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, but also patients with HIV. Some of the HIV medications make the cholesterol very high, but that chronic inflammation also adds to their risk of cardiovascular disease. Those are groups that basically have never been told they need to be on a statin, and many rheumatologists worry that patients with underlying rheumatologic disorders will get more muscle aches and joint pains with the statin, so they frequently don't recommend them. And then another group is women who've had problems with their pregnancy, particularly preeclampsia, but also high blood pressure during pregnancy and gestational diabetes. These women are at higher risk for premature menopause and heart disease younger. So these women need to consider statins. And then it also included some of our advanced lipids, such as lipoprotein little A, that runs in families, that really adds to the risk of heart disease. And then C-reactive protein, an inflammatory marker, and ApoB. And many prevention clinics draw advanced lipids and have these numbers. And so now patients can respond to all of their risk factors, not just the traditional ones, but these newer risk factors that are quite important. And then another great thing the guidelines did is they looked at ethnicities. South Asians are very high risk for heart disease, and that's a growing population in our country. We've known for years that Blacks and Hispanics and Latinos have high risk, particularly for metabolic syndrome and diabetes. So it looks at what we need to do best for women. So it's gender focused, and it's also ethnic and race focused. And so these are very important guidelines for dealing with a person individually and specifically for them when you're seeing them in clinic. So I really applaud the writers of the guideline. I think they did a really good encompassing job of giving us an easy document, giving us some easy targets, and making it simple.
Yeah, and just for our listeners, I'm just going to summarize, you know, our traditional factors and then some of the new ones. So traditionally for heart disease, we know that diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, tobacco use, carrying extra weight, and family history are the factors that we always think about, you know, who's at risk for heart disease. And these new guidelines emphasize probably what we don't do enough of a good job communicating that put people at risk. So if any of our listeners have rheumatologic conditions such as psoriasis, lupus, HIV and its medications, women who've had complications of pregnancy, people who carry hereditary factors such as lipoprotein A, APO, lipoprotein B, chronic kidney disease, also made the list, elevations in C-reactive protein, which is a marker of inflammation. These are also risk factors for heart disease. And people with these conditions need to be very vigilant about their cholesterol and manage it, you know, whether it's through medication or lifestyle. So I think that's a really important point from these new guidelines. And one thing that I see a lot, and I'm sure you do too, are people who are kind of deciding if they have to be on a cholesterol medication or if they can, kind of manage their cholesterol through diet and exercise, especially people who are concerned about the side effects, the muscle aches, or have experienced the muscle aches. Can you maybe speak a little bit about ways to look beyond just cholesterol and deciding who needs to be treated with medication and who maybe could work a little harder on lifestyle?
Well, I think two things are very, very helpful for deciding, particularly when a patient probably should be on the statin, but they don't want to be on the statin, is getting the coronary artery calcium score, or it's a CAT scan of the chest, of the heart, to look at calcification in the coronary arteries. When someone has atherosclerosis in their coronary arteries, over time that will age and then it becomes calcified. So the calcium isn't the problem, it's just a marker that the problem is there. But a calcium score, particularly after age 50, 55, is extremely useful in identifying risk. So if your score is still zero after 55, and even better if it's still zero after 65, those are generally very low-risk people, and they might not need a statin, and then they can be reassigned to a lower-risk category. But if your calcium score is even one and you're over 55, that favors use of a statin. And if the calcium score is high, over 100, or your percentile of risk is over 75th percentile, you definitely would benefit from statin. It should be initiated. Another test that, so unfortunately, the calcium score is not covered by insurance companies. In most areas, it runs about $100. You can get it at Emory, but it's also available at most of the large hospitals in the whole Atlanta area and across the country. Another test that can be done, though, is called the ankle brachial index, which is simply done by measuring blood pressures in the arms and the legs and calculating a ratio. And if that comes out low, that's also an indicator that it's a surrogate marker for coronary disease and peripheral artery disease. And that's a person who could also benefit from statin. So those are two relatively low-risk tests that can be done with your doctor. I'm giving you the order for the calcium score, or the ABI can be done in your doctor's office. Both very helpful tests for determining if you really should go ahead and get on that statin.
And that's really very helpful. And if a person has a score of zero on these coronary calcium CTs, but has a fairly high cholesterol, let's say, something that's considerably above 200 and they've tried their best at diet and they're working really hard on diet and exercise, is that person in your mind still fairly low risk?
Yes. Interestingly, there are groups of people who have very high cholesterol, but they don't develop atherosclerosis. There's a group of French Canadians who have high cholesterol, but fortunately don't get coronary artery disease or peripheral artery disease, but that's rare. Usually the person with a high cholesterol number is going to have problems. And one of the easiest ways is, to ask about family history. If mom, dad, grandparents had heart disease and your numbers are high, you're heading in that direction too. But I do think that we call it the power of zero. A calcium score of zero is very powerful. And the older you are, the more important. So if you're 45 and at zero, that's not a big deal because it should be zero. If you're 55 and at zero, that's very good. And if you're 65 and at zero, now I'm going to quit worrying about you and I'm going to let you not take your statin. So I think they're very helpful tests.
And I think the new guidelines addressing that and maybe using that as a tool to decide who needs it beyond just the risk factors, I think is just a very helpful tool to have. And women specifically, you've touched on complications of pregnancy being something that women should pay attention to as a risk factor for heart disease. And you had mentioned that menopause as well and some of the changes. Can you speak more about risks that women should be aware of that are unique to women as opposed to heart disease in general?
Well, pregnancy is actually the first stress test that our heart ever undergoes. If you go through a pregnancy that's full term, normal vaginal delivery, healthy weight baby, you don't have problems with your glucose, you don't have problems with blood pressure, you've already passed your first stress test. But unfortunately, so many women have complications with pregnancy. If you have high blood pressure, even at the end in labor and delivery, that's concerning. And obviously, if you've had eclampsia or preeclampsia, that's very worrisome. Gestational diabetes is worrisome. And one of the problems is the diabetes guidelines have gotten more stringent recently. So a woman who was having children back in the 60s, 70s, we don't really have a way of knowing if she had gestational diabetes, except to ask if her baby was over 9 pounds. And in general, having had a 9-pound baby is a marker for future heart disease as well. Women also who take hormones for birth control, those are a certain risk, particularly for blood clots. And then women of menopausal age taking hormones also have risk. We know from the Women's Health Initiative that the risk of stroke and heart attack is increased, but there's also an increased risk of breast cancer and blood clots. So women have these unique risks related to our hormones. We also are different than men. Our presentation with chest pain and angina can be different. It can be more subtle, such as you just feel tired or sluggish, you're short of breath. A lot of women will say, I'm not having chest pain, but they'll use the word tightness or heaviness or feeling like there's a band around their chest. So a lot of times the presentation isn't the same in women. And a lot of times physicians aren't listening for that, and they're thinking, well, you're just, you know, tired or having stomach issues. One of the problems is the awareness. And when it comes to women with heart disease, only about half of the women in this country even know that heart disease is the number one killer. And then unfortunately, women so often are, you know, into the doctor for this or that, and they don't talk about cardiovascular risk factors. And so only about 40% of women even get a heart check during their exam with their primary care doctor. And even more worrisome, only about less than 25% of primary care doctors and less than 50% of cardiologists feel that they're well equipped to assess a woman for cardiovascular disease because the symptoms can be so subtle. So a woman really has to be her own advocate. She has to know these risk factors, and she has to speak up for herself when she's worried that something is going on with heart disease.
Yeah, and that's such an important point that, you know, when we focus on women's health, we really tend to automatically go down the path of thinking, you know, breast cancer, female-related cancers, and more the cancer screenings, and the point that heart disease is still the number one killer in women, and that should be center point for women's health is just, I think, as you just said, very, I guess, it gets lost in the message and underemphasized. For women who are trying to advocate for themselves, and let's say they, you know, go for their routine preventive visit once a year, are there specific things that they should have as part of that evaluation that you would recommend?
Well, certainly they need their blood pressure checked, and they need their weight and height to calculate the BMI so they know if they're maintaining a healthy weight. A lot of women won't have cholesterol routinely. They may be checking hemoglobin and hematocrit if they're still menstruating to make sure they're not anemic. But a lot of times I'll see a woman who hasn't had a cholesterol checked in 4 or 5 years. Also, keeping up with the blood sugar is very important. It needs to be 99 or lower. And in most healthy women, it's a lot lower than 90. And then any symptoms that would lead you to need an EKG. You don't need an EKG at every visit, even after 50. But if you've had heaviness, tightness, palpitations, racing spells, feeling faint, passing out, that woman definitely needs an EKG. So a lot of times, you know, you just rush in, they listen to your heart and your lungs, you get a blood pressure, you get your pelvic exam, and you're out the door. I think women should stop and say, have we covered my heart risk factors? Are there other things we could do? Do I need my cholesterol checked? Do I need my blood sugar checked? And really be more of an advocate. I do recommend for a lot of women, particularly once they're past childbearing into the age of, say, 45 or 50, get an internist or a family practitioner in addition to your gynecologist so that you are getting a head-to-toe, a full body evaluation and not just a bikini evaluation.
Yeah, being in internal medicine, thank you for that. I think the approach is a little different, even though there is overlap. And menopause specifically, you know, a lot of women, when they're transitioning through menopause, notice changes in their body, particularly a little increase in belly fat, maybe a slight increase in their cholesterol. How does menopause impact the risk of heart disease? And are there specific things women who are going through menopause should start to do more of? Obviously, the exercise piece. But how do you advise your woman patients?
Well, unfortunately, I tell women menopause does everything bad to us. it drops our good cholesterol, the HDL. It increases our LDL and it increases our triglycerides. So the lipid triad, they all go in the wrong direction. Our arteries get stiffer, less elastic, and so blood pressure does start to creep up. Usually the first to go up is the bottom number, the diastolic, and then as we get older, the systolic goes up too, so they're both up. We do become more insulin resistant or more diabetic-like, and so the blood sugar can start to go up, and the weight gain around the abdomen is associated with that. And so I've even heard women call menopause menabelly because they really notice that weight gain around the abdomen. The bones obviously are changing too. In those first years around menopause, the calcium in the bone can really drop. I think it's important to have weight-bearing exercise that can simply be walking to keep up with activity, maybe even try to increase your activity at that point. And we have to be very mindful of our calories. Most women have to cut back on their calorie intake about 100 calories per decade. So by the time you're 60, you've sort of like, you know, you're skipping lunch now because that can be another 400 calories. I think just having good health habits by 30 and then maintaining them till you're 99 is the ideal, but it does get harder. And I think that we have to, you know, acknowledge that with our patients. I have women who say, I'm really, really trying. And being a woman, I can sympathize because I'm trying too. But it is harder. And I think we have to just encourage them and, you know, find ways for them to get that support they need. I really encourage women joining group exercises like, you know, Zumba or pickleball, because then you have a lot of fun and support. But really just staying active is the key.
Yeah. And I hear this a lot too from a lot of my female patients that they really often get frustrated because they're doing the same. They haven't really changed anything and they're seeing the weight gain, especially around the belly and the changes in their blood work profile, and realizing that it's okay to notice that change despite working really hard and maybe doing the same isn't enough, that we do have to cut back on calories and exercise more, and it's frustrating and it's hard, but the body changes and how we take care of our body has to change over time as well. Dr. Lindberg, thank you so much. This has just been really great advice, and I appreciate all that you do for women in the heart disease program and all of the time, effort, and energy you spend on awareness and promoting the importance of prevention for heart disease. So I can't thank you enough for your time. Are there any final thoughts that you want to share with our listeners?
I think the most important thing is to be your advocate, see your doctor, speak up, talk about things. If you feel like someone's not paying attention to you or your issues aren't being addressed, then find another doctor. Be your advocate. And again, just underlining that exercise and healthy diet is the most important thing we do. It's the best prescription we have. And if your doctor says it's time for you to take a statin, seriously consider that. We're not here to harm people. We're here to help people, and particularly people involved with prevention like you and I, Sharon. We really want to see good outcomes and results. And it breaks our heart when somebody has a stroke or a heart attack. And we really do want to prevent that.
Yeah, thank you so much. I couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sharon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Emory. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.